us stand for prayer. Eternal Father in heaven, we bow in your presence, and we thank you for what we have just heard, and we ask that you would not let us forget these things. Would you impress these truths deep into our souls and teach us even further about this? Father, there's a mystery here that's beyond human definitions and comprehension. Some of it's your work. And yet you have a plan that we enter into this. And Father, these are deep things. And so we just ask that you would open our hearts further. That you give us quiet hearts to be able to perceive and hear the voice of your Spirit as you teach us further about these things. So our Father, please be present now. Give me wisdom to speak for you. And may we all have ears to hear from you, that we might be blessed together in your presence. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Be seated. First of all, thank you, Brother Lucas. That was extremely important, more important than we realize. And I may talk more about that as we go along. Except to say just this at this point. Part of the Anabaptist story has been that they have insisted that these two remain together. Roman Catholicism focused on this for 1,000 years. And then Martin Luther came along and insisted on this. And the Anabaptists said, I know this is not quite parallel here. Got to be both. But it wasn't just the rituals that they're talking about. They're talking about the fruits of faith. That's a whole subject itself. We just have to leave that. There's so much there. Okay, changing gears just a little bit. We've been talking about stories. We've talking in particular about the Russian Mennonite story. And we talked about the failure of the story yesterday evening and how Mennonites became Nazis. Tragic story. And I'm hearing your hearts, and I hear my own heart, and we want it to go, to come from out there. We want to come in close because we are alive in the world today, and we are a part of this story. And God is expecting to work himself out in every single one of our lives. And so if there are 200 people sitting here today, there are 200 stories in progress. And we are extremely interested in how this story is unfolding in our own experience. I'm 63. I'm further along in my story than these young ladies here. Looks like they're teenagers. They're getting started with their story. But if they're normal, they are wondering, how is this supposed to work? I mean, sometimes preachers and teachers talk about all these abstract things, you know, and but how does it come into reality? How do we walk this stuff out? It looks like the old people, all they know how it works. Except they look, the young people look around and they say, inconsistency there, failure here. These people all professing wonderful stuff. Okay, we're going to talk about that kind of stuff today. I'd like to begin with this. We can't go real far on this. I'll take the lights out here. The question is, how does faith reproduce itself? I sense that's the heart of this congregation. How does this congregation reproduce itself? Or is individual families, how does a family, a husband and wife, pass their faith on to the children? Okay, well, there's several things I want you to notice. First of all, the non-living things don't even reproduce at all. The only way a non-living thing can reproduce is like a rock. You can take a sledgehammer and hit it, and it breaks into several pieces. That, I guess you call that reproduction, but I don't really think so. Because it's not reproduction, it's just cracking off some of what was there to start with. So we could say dead faith doesn't reproduce itself. But living things do. This is true for microscopic life, fungi, plants, animals, and man. And they all reproduce themselves because they possess DNA. Now, we're not doing a science lesson this morning, but if you want to know more about that, it is incredibly complex. And yet it's incredibly simple at the same time. Do you know that they just recently figured out the human genome, all that's in there, how it all fits together? And they are saying, this is so complex, this is impossible for this to happen by chance, such as evolution teaches. It's impossible. And yet that's what's happening in every one of our cells all the time. It's what happens, that how genes are passed on from parents to offspring. From the husband, genes from a husband, we'll say on the human side, and genes from a wife come together, and each child contains genes from both parents, but no child is exactly the same, even though they came from the same parents. And even identical twins are not exactly the same. It's amazing. Okay. But the DNA passed on does create exact replicas. When I use the word exact, I'm talking about a relative term. We don't have half dog and half cat, we'll say. Okay, you can't even cross those kinds. Okay, it's the DNA within the species that reproduces itself. Okay, now that's in the natural world. Now, you come closer. What works in the natural world among plants and animals, both of which are alive? They all contain DNA. This is characteristic of life, brothers and sisters. All life is like this. It contains DNA. It always responds to stimuli. It can move in some way. It always takes materials and energy from the environment. It is always highly organized and structured. It always reproduces. And it always has the ability to die. Okay? 6 basic characteristics of life. Okay, when I'm up here listening to Lucas talk, I'm going to have some lights on a little bit. This is really not my subject, but he really provoked my thoughts. If this is my father, and I have received from his DNA biologically, but I'm not talking about now. I'm talking about stuff that I received from him in terms of a spiritual kind of DNA. I am the product of my father. I wish you could see my father. Was he a fallible person? Yes. Did I struggle with his humanity? Yes. But there's something I treasure about his faith. I don't know if I'd be standing here this morning if it wouldn't have been for his faith. Something about the DNA of his faith. And my mother. And you see, you and I both can think about our parents and what we receive from them by way of their DNA. So here am I, okay, in the spiritual realm. There is no formula, brothers and sisters. As much as we would like it, there is no exact formula. If you put A plus B plus C minus D equals E, there is none. There is none. As much as we would like it. Because God has somehow designed that while Father lives his faith, loves his Lord, is and does, he creates an invitation to his children saying, let's go this way. This is a good way. I started reading Anabaptist history and I saw the whole DNA of a group of people saying, this is the way. And the story
of how they have lived for 500 years of this, in spite of all their failures, has inspired me, along with my father, to say, yes, that is the way forward. Now, my father did not reach back and try to grab me. As parents, that's very human. We want to grab our children and make them go the right way. Well, do you know what happens when children feel like their parents are making them go the right way? They rebel. Right now, there's a living tragedy in the homeschool movement in the United States. Parents who poured their lives into their children in the 90s and in the 80s, teaching them all the right things. You could say even pushing them into the right ways, including Bill Gothard's system. Huge numbers of those children are in the process of rebelling against their parents today. Because there was something missing. As I would understand it, part of it has to do with this thing right here. There's a divine and there's a human way of doing things. This is the divine, this is the human. And what our brother Lucas was talking about related husbands to wives, I'm still learning about things like that. I'm 63 and I just feel like I have so much to learn about that. But whenever my wife and my children see me joyful in being and finding God's blessing in being and following that up with doing, it's a delight to do thy will, O God. That is powerful in inviting our children to move forward from father to son. And eventually, and I'll say this unequivocally, since I have seen in my parents and in many examples of faith that I grew up with, and now as I've read history, I feel solidly linked to all that came before me. Now, my story is still open. My oldest son is now 41 and my youngest daughter is 18. The proof of my parenting is not in my children. The proof of my parenting is in my grandchildren. Because if I can make a solid link, okay, this is me. If I can do the same thing for my children that my father did for me and the people in my environment did for me, so that every one of my children have a solid link, that it's okay. But that's not proven yet. Not proven. And I care about this. And I feel strange because I live in Indiana and none of my grandchildren live in Indiana. I'm going to Texas here shortly. And I'll at least have a chance to deal with and live with and work with my grandchildren there. But I have three sets of grandchildren in California. What in the world? How can I grandparent my children by being in Indiana when they're in California? And not only that, how am I have children who live in Virginia. How can I do my job as a grandparent there? I know that's my problem to figure out. That's not your problem. But what I need to do is see to it that I do all I can. But you see, all I can do is only half. The other half, there's something divine here. Oh, brothers and sisters, God has designed that in human reproduction, it's the male and the female coming together. And when it comes to faith reproduction, it's man and God together. That's His design. I can do what I can, right here. But some of the rest of it has to be done by God. God will not do for me what I'm supposed to do. I cannot do what God is supposed to do. And so the two have to come together. And when those two come together in right ways, that is a powerful way to move forward like this. Now, does that mean that it's always going to work? No. We're going to talk about that shortly with what I have to share this morning. Because every child has their own choices in faith that they must personally make. Okay, so I'm just going to leave that. Lucas ended up saying, look, there's more to talk about here. He sensed there's a deep mystery here. And I do too. He invited some input and some feedback. I would do the same thing, except that we're not going to be doing that right now. Maybe we can talk about that in the fellowship time afterwards. Let me read to you a few verses, a few words in the book of Ephesians. It's interesting that we're focused on Ephesians here this morning. I'm just pulling some verses out here as a basis for what I'm going to speak. This is Ephesians 4:15, speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things into Him who is the head, Christ. Speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things into Him who is the head, Christ. Now, this is what I understand. I'm not God. But I've shared this before, and it seems to resonate, and this is not even original with me, but it seems to fit with the way it works. Okay, you'll notice up here in the head is Christ. And we're talking about growing up into Him. It's this process right here. Now, from what we're going to be assuming, is that below the feet here is the unconverted state. Beginning here is people who have named the name of Christ, who have decided they're going to become a child of God. Okay? Folks, I understand that nobody grows up without going through every one of these stages. Some linger in some stages longer than others. And you'll find that we sometimes are in several stages at once. And if you're at a higher stage, you tend to look back and you say, oh, wow. Why was I so slow to get out of that? But you don't move from one stage to another without being moved by God to do that. And this is the story that's working out in us. And folks, sitting here today, we have people in all these stages right now. And it's okay. Everybody starts here. And we move up through. And that's what we want to talk about today. There's so much of the Christian life that we just wonder about. And this, what I'm going to share with you today is a help to understand what's going on. Okay, I'm going to be referring to this overhead quite often. So let me explain what's going on here, and I'm going to take it off, and we're going to look at some other things. Okay, the stage one, we'll call the carnal stage, is whenever a person first chooses Christ. Apostle Paul refers in 1 Corinthians, he says, are you not yet carnal? When you are involved with envy and strife and party spirit and all that kind of stuff. So there is such a thing as a, quote, carnal Christian. It's where you start. You think about yourself when you were started, those of you older. Did you have any ups and downs? Did you struggle really much with the flesh sometimes? Did you sometimes feel you're a really good Christian? You're close to God. You felt on fire for Him. And about 3 days later, you wonder whether you even were a Christian. Up and down. Instability. Okay? We're going to call that the carnal stage. Stage one. Somewhere along the line, as we allow the Spirit of Christ to work in us, we say, there's a problem with that carnal stage. That's stage one. That's not real Christianity. That's not what I see in the church and in the Scriptures. There's something more than that. And so we tend to move up into stage two, which is the sacral stage. Now, the sacral stage is characterized by the doing things over here on this that Lucas put up here. There are ordinances. You know, Christian women wear head coverings. It's visible. It's a practice. And we do take communion. And we do wash feet. And we ought to believe the right thing. Orthodoxy, correct belief, is right. And some people, and these are the outer things. Things you can get a hold of. And you think, well, you know, we've got to do right and be right and so on. And because when we get that right, then we're right. Okay, that's what sacral stage is all about. We think that Christianity is tied up in these kinds of things. But after a while, in stage two for a while, we begin to realize, you know what? Christianity is really more than that. And so the Spirit of God begins to move us to number three, stage three, the question stage, which is the most dangerous stage of all. The very first thing that happens is we begin to ask questions about these things. Stage two. And if you verbalize that question to certain people, the first thing you're going to hear is, be quiet. Don't ask questions. Just get busy and do it. Shut up. I don't know either. We just do it. And you say, whoa, I'm never going to ask that question again. And there are some groups of Christian people who believe this is all the further you should go. You just stay in stage two. Don't ask any questions. This is the way we've always done it. I don't know why we do it, but this is what we do. Shut up. Grin and bear it. Make the best of it. Don't even read your Bible. Just trust the leaders that they know what they're doing and we'll be okay. Don't rock the boat. And some scared, timid people who don't have their identity all sorted out say, okay. But if they're close to Christ, this question is going to arise again. And if it rises again, they probably will not ask the same person who said, shut up the first time. They'll ask somebody else the next time. And they may ask a book. They may ask a neighbor. They may ask a seminar. They may ask a DVD. Everybody needs answers to their questions. And questions are right. That's the way God made us. And so, as we enter into the question stage, number two here, this is to the leaders of this congregation, and this is to fathers in this congregation. Your children and the young people who are growing up deserve good answers for the questions that they raise. The worst thing we can do as fathers or leaders is to tell them to shut up. We should welcome their questions. If their son asks or daughter asks, you say, you know, I raised that same question. I thought about that same thing whenever I was young. Encourage them to ask all the questions they want. Because if you don't do that, they are going to get answers somewhere. And some of those questions can be answered with wrong answers. You know, there's a true and a false in the world. And if your children are asking questionable people about answers to their questions, they'll probably get questionable answers. And many times, young people who do not get good answers for their questions go out into the world because they think the answers are out there someplace. Or if they're not quite that bold, they'll go to some kind of church that is basically in the world and they'll get religious worldly answers. And so they'll live in the world but have a religious guise to them and they feel good about the answers they got. But it's the wrong answers. They're still in the world, whether or not it's in the church. But the counterpart to this is there are good answers. And this has been a weakness of Anabaptist people. I'm sorry. We just might as well confess our sins where they are. We have reacted to the past. It was the educated people who killed us. The educated people found scriptural reasons, theological reasons for destroying us. And we said, okay, if that's what education is, I don't want any of it. Get the bare minimum of education. Go to eighth grade, that's it. Get busy with the world. Sorry. That's a reaction. And we are paying for that today. Now, does that mean that higher education is the answer? I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we better know some good answers. And our anti-intellectual stance has not served us so well. And this is one of the reasons so many young people have left. Because they have not found satisfactory answers from their parents and their churches. But there are good answers. When I was in high school, I only went to public school. I never went to Christian school, even though I've been a Christian school teacher. I had a teacher in 10th grade who said he's going to have me believing in evolution by the end of the year. Well, where am I going to get my answers? At least I talked to my father about it. And back in those days, there were no creation apologetics like creationism has today. Answers in Genesis and Institute for Creation Research. The only thing my dad gave me was a little book about this tall and about this wide called The Twilight of Evolution by Henry Morris. That's all. Well, I was young and dumb and I didn't know very much. But the faith of my people answered something in my soul. And so I said, okay, I can't answer this. So I kind of put the question on the shelf. And now later, I find out there's all kinds of good answers to those questions. But I and my little mind and little heart were not able to handle them at that point. My people's faith carried me through. Okay, that's apologetics. That's in terms of questions of basic faith. But there are also questions, since we are raised and live in a particular cultural environment, many young people have questions as to why we do it this way and other people do it that way. Well, again, there are good answers to that. And this is one of the reasons why young people go to Bible school, to get good answers to their questions. It's one of the good reasons for having Bible schools. And it's a good place for young people. It's safe for young people to ask those questions in a Bible school context. But in a Bible school context, we better make sure that we have some good answers for those questions. Okay? When young people get good answers to their questions, it gives them a sense of security and stability, and it makes them feel like reaching out for their father's faith. They personalize it. They take it in, and they say, this is mine. I buy into this. Okay, moving on. You'll notice here there's a number three, another basic question. And I would say this has to do with personal integrity, and I cannot emphasize this enough. We could spend all the rest of the morning talking about this, but we can't. Let me put this one first. Inner truth, integrity. This is written by Paul Turnier. He says, man both seeks truth and flees from it. Though man flees from truth, he does not stop seeking it as well. He needs truth in order to live. The love of truth is the source of all harmony within oneself. That explains why young people ask the questions. They're trying to bring harmony and integrity within their own hearts. We don't like to have a divided heart by nature. It doesn't feel good to have questions unanswered within us. And some of those questions have to do with how we're going to look at life. Here's what I mean. Let me tell you a story on the first one here. Integrity is truth-telling, no spin. One of my sons decided whenever he turned 18, he didn't want a car, he wanted a pickup truck. And he wanted a four-wheel drive pickup truck. Because four-wheel drive pickup trucks, they can do anything. And so we kind of reluctantly helped him buy a used four-wheel drive pickup. Well, one day, he and his brother were down visiting a neighbor, and it was in the evening. After a while, I got a call from him, and he said, Father, I think God's trying to teach me some humility. I said, what happened? He said, well, I rolled my truck. Well, it so happened that he was driving up a gravel road, and at the end of the gravel road, there was a slight curve. Well, as he went around the curve, he flipped it and landed right back up on his wheels again. But both he and his brother were strapped in, so they weren't hurt at all. The truck had some damage. So we got the truck fixed and went on with life. And one day, this son, same son, was supposed to lead songs at church. And he was going in his truck by himself to church. And as he's running up the road in Texas, it gets pretty hot sometimes and some tar comes to the surface. And it had started to rain that morning a little bit. As he's coming around this curve, just a gentle curve in the road, the back end of his truck came around like this. And whatever the side of the road on the gravel went, plip! As it's flipped right upside down, this time the roof was in the water. And a songbook was floating, and his Bible was floating, and there he was hanging from his seatbelt. And so he unhooked himself and got out. I was supposed to preach that morning, so my I didn't know anything was going on. They didn't tell me anything. My wife left. Okay, why am I telling you this? Well, the first time, you know, he slid on the gravel. And the second time, he hydroplaned. I said, okay, son, what's the real issue? You see, human nature doesn't like to tell cold, hard facts that kind of reflect on one's personal problems. It's always a way to explain them away. So I went to you young man, hey, what was my son's problem in both of those cases? Exactly. He was driving too fast. But see, he could blame it on he slipped on the gravel and he hydroplaned. That's spin. It's not telling the truth. So, in human nature, we always want to excuse ourselves and give spin to our stories. We don't want to tell the truth the way it is because it reflects against us in some negative ways. This is integrity. Furthermore, integrity has to do with being single-minded, not double-minded. Sometimes it's this way if I'm with this group of people, and sometimes it's this way when I'm with another group of people. That's not the single eye that Jesus talks about. If you're in business, this is a tough one. You make commitments, got to keep them. Or else we should be careful about making commitments. I know, I've been in business myself. I know something about this. But sometimes businesses rise when the customers realize that there's integrity in this business. If they say it, they will come through. Other businesses struggle because their customers realize that there's a question whether they're going to come through or not. Integrity has to do with not cheating. I'm a school teacher. This is one of the debts I owe my students. I need to catch them in every case they cheat. If they get away with it, I am not serving them. Let me tell you another story. I had a little boy in my class. I think this was the very first year I was teaching. And it was so far back, we had outhouses. We didn't even have indoor plumbing. And so one day, a little boy came to me and he said, so-and-so put his lunch down the outhouse hole. Okay, so I called this other little boy and I said, did you do that? No. I got two boys, one saying yes, one saying no. Somebody's right, somebody's wrong. So I started checking other boys and girls. Nobody knew anything. And so I messed around trying to figure this thing out. And so we had church that night. And I went to church and this boy was accused of dumping his lunch down the hole. His mother said to me, she said, if he says he didn't do it, he didn't do it. So I went back to school the next day.
I had to work on this some more. So I called this little boy out and I said, if I would tell you that I would give you less swats if you admit it, would you admit it? Right there it was. This guy was so good at lying that he had his mother wrapped around his finger. And he looked so innocent when he was looking. He was just a short guy. And he's looking up at me with his face and he looked all sincere. Excellent liar. I don't know. I hope I have not stayed close to him. I don't know where his life is real in detail. But look, folks, this is something that parents and teachers owe children, not to let them get away with lying. Not even shading the truth. Part of integrity is being objective, fact-oriented, non-prejudiced. Okay, when you live in Texas, the prejudice in the South is against blacks. Such that if you have a swimming pool and a black swims in your swimming pool, you got to drain all the water out before a white can swim in it again. Okay? So, and I came from Texas and northern Indiana 8 years ago. Guess what I found out? I think the second day I was in school, I found out that the prejudice in northern Indiana is against Amish. Not against blacks. One little boy in my class, I think the second day, said, Amish, Amish, Amish. Everything's Amish. Amish, Amish, Amish. And I said, boy, I said, I don't think you know what you're talking about. Don't you know there are people who pay to come here to see these people? And I've been to other places. And I Calvary Bible School. A big girl, I think she looks like she's about 19. Her pet peeve is driving behind a buggy uphill when you can't pass it. Maybe you folks don't have anti-Amish Amish prejudice down here, but I tell you, it's alive and well where I come from. Okay. That's integrity failure. Fair, not partial. As a school teacher, I've learned through the years, that is probably the number one issue for young children. They want to know whether the teacher is fair or not. And if the teacher is not fair, I might as well quit if they don't perceive me to be fair. I better go over backwards so that I am so up above board, there's no question about whether I'm fair or not. Okay, so as soon as I have my own children in my class, guess what the first question is? They're going to get preferential treatment over the rest of us. And so this is unfair to teachers, I know, teachers' children. I felt like I needed to, if there's any question, my children have to be below other children. I have to be harder on my own children than I am other children so that they can't say that. You ever hear of teacher's pets? That's bad enough. If your children are the teacher's pets, that is, might as well forget it. Here's a big one. In no insinuation, no innuendo. Okay, I know Brother Allen, so I'm going to use him for an example. What this means is, if I would tell this brother right here, he's sitting at the front, I'm picking on you again. If I would say, this is not true at all, Brother Allen, please. Okay, and for the rest of you, this is not true at all, but I've got to pick on somebody. Okay. And you're safe to pick on, Brother Allen. Okay. If I say, what's your first name?
Marvin.
Marvin. There's one of your ministers down there. I'm not going to say who it is, but just watch out. Don't ask me too many questions. Just watch out. I mean, you wouldn't believe what all he's done already. You, pardon? He's a snake in the grass. Just watch out. Okay. Now, did I tell a lie? Did I? Did I say anything bad? If Brother Allen would come to me and he says, what did you tell Brother Marvin?
Did you say that I am dishonest? I said, no, I didn't. Well, did I? Not directly. Did I imply it? I lied. I failed with integrity without actually saying the words. That's what insinuation and innuendo is. This is great ways. People can be, quote, Christian, not tell lies, but they can destroy people by being dishonest. You see, this is a huge destroyer of Christian fellowships right there. When we relate to our brothers, they automatically get preferential treatment. We defend our brothers. Just like, if you come attack my wife, guess what my first response is? It's my job to defend her. And it's your job to defend each other in this fellowship. And if you hear something, your first thought is, I don't believe it. You're innocent until you're proven guilty. That is love in action. If other people are suspect, they're guilty until proven innocent. That's not how fellowships work and prosper long term. Integrity has to do with being consistent. Integrity has to do with honoring promises, even if it hurts. Integrity has to do with keeping confidences. Have you ever told somebody something and say, don't you dare tell anybody else? But it was so juicy that you had to tell somebody but make them promise that they won't tell. You know how that goes. You don't do that. If somebody gives you a confidence, it's zip lips. Period. Guileless. No hypocrisy. I learned so much about that from my wife. I better not go there. Being true to who I am, no pretense. What you see is what you get. I better be the same person today, right now, at 11:40, than I am an hour from now, and that I am at home, and that I am at school. Same person. You never see a different person. Same person. That's integrity. Now, folks, this is a big, big thing for young people. Back to our picture here. Now, number three is a huge thing for young people to come to terms with. And the sooner they learn this integrity stuff, the better they are. And the sooner they can get on with life. How can you get on with life getting married without learning integrity? Do many people learn it? The question in my mind is, how many people really learn integrity before they're married? Unfortunately, there's a lot of people who still have to learn a bunch about integrity after they're married, which makes it more difficult. Okay. I didn't put this up here, but this has to do with this prejudice thing. Prejudice has to do with people prejudged. It has to do with being subjective, how I feel. There's no factual basis. Are Amish people all that bad? I've learned that in northern Indiana, one of the reasons that they don't like Amish is because Amish sometimes prove them with their characters that they do a better job than what the people are who are making the statements about them. And I guess it's the old thing of sometimes righteousness, strange ways of convicting. I'm not saying that about all of them, but I think that has to do with some of it. Okay, prejudice, moral judgments with no factual basis. Don't confuse me with the facts. I've already made up my mind. That's why the Holocaust happened, because the people in Germany, including Mennonites, refused to be objective about this and bought the groupthink who said Jews are bad. We've already talked about race. I don't know if you folks have... And there are Mennonite fads as well as worldly fads. You don't know that. Maybe you're so isolated down here you don't know that. But fads wherever, they're cool. And if you attack a fad, beware. Can you explain why a fad is so cool? No, but it's still cool. Shut up. social status, wealth, family, celebrity, sports. Oh, I get into trouble in Northern Indiana when I talk about this thing, sports. I'm not a very good softball player, but I found out when I got to Northern Indiana that a person is a person in terms of how well he can play softball. Well, I must not be very much of a person because I can't play softball very well. And I have had to say things about sports being idols. It's idolatry. Oh, I don't like that. They're good Christians. Yet sports are important. Well, I'm not going to go there. The tyranny of everybody does it. That really doesn't make it right, just because everybody else does it. Okay, you'll notice that on this question stage, there's a number 4 here. And it's the key to going up to stage 4, which is maturity. Okay, look at this. See, when we're going to deal with integrity issues, or we're going to deal with questions, dealing with hard things as young people, the very first way of handling it is, I will, with my personal determination, I will step up. I will pull myself up from my own bootstraps. Well, that's the weakest way of doing this. The least amount of power. And so we can move on to the group, and we're going to say, we will. We're going to have group determination. We're going to have accountability. And so we're going to hold each other accountable. Well, that's okay. But can a group pull itself up by its own bootstraps? No. Still a problem. And the only way this happens, and this is beyond my language, this is a mystery, this is the work of God, it's called empowerment. The I am, God Himself, when I surrender to Him, does something in my soul, in my spirit, where He reaches out and gets a hold of me. And I can't... If we have a problem, this is where we get on our knees and cry out to God. And my experience is he probably won't even answer the first time. Well, we just need to struggle with God in faith and allow Him. Many times it's our problem. He's ready to it immediately. Surrender to Him. And when we surrender to Him, the I Am reaches out of heaven with unlimited transcendent power to lift us and to help us. And if you've been born again and you've been converted by the Spirit of God, you know what I'm talking about. And when we have that happen to us, then we're able to move up into stage 4, maturity. So we need to spend some time here talking about this stage of maturity. Before we get there, I want to look at this. Here is childhood, innocence, precious little children who are very concerned about fairness, justice, and morality, that kind of thing, which is around a stage 2 kind of thing. But they are bent to evil. So their human nature, when they come to the age of accountability, takes them down. And they get involved with the sins of the flesh, such as immorality or theft and all those other kinds of things. And sins of the spirit, such as jealousy, covetousness, and so on. Okay, then they get converted, and they go through stage 1. They come back up to stage 2. They go through stage 3. And they move on to stage 4, which is a higher ethic. And this is where we is norm for Christian experience. We get here as soon as possible into the areas of forgiveness and reconciliation, integrity, humility. And we want to explore that further. Now, reviewing just a little bit. With this stage 2, where we are preoccupied with rules and standards, rituals, ordinances, observable practices, orthodox theology, it always generates a what's wrong with? A person who's in stage 2 is, when he's testing the boundaries, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with that? Why can't we do this? Why can't we do that? Blah, blah, blah. Well, all these things are enforceable short of coercion. But think, it often continually raises this question. And if somebody continually asks this question, what's wrong with, you can mark it down, they're probably struggling at stage two. Because when you get through the question stage and get those questions answered, and you get up into stage four, it's like this. Well, I don't see Brother Allen. Is Brother Aiden over there? Where? I can't see you in the dark. Brother Aiden, how many cups of cold water are your people allowed to give in one day here? There's no limit. Okay, Brother Aiden, how many times are your people allowed to forgive here in this church? There's no limit. Well, Jesus' disciples were concerned about that. They thought maybe seven times is the limit. And Jesus said 490 times. And so is that your limit? They can go beyond that. Okay. How many times are your people allowed to do a Good Samaritan work in one day? No limit on that one either. Well, how many times can they perform the Golden Rule in one day? No, there's no limit on that either. How many times are they allowed to overcome evil with good? And there's no limit on that either. Ooh, you got some unlimited stuff down here. How many times are a person die to himself in a day's time? How many times should he reach out to other people and bless other people in some way? No limit. Wow. Brother Aiden, do you try to enforce any of that kind of stuff here at your church? Are you planning to in the near future? I don't think you should even try. Because this is unenforceable. It's like Jesus says, I delight to do thy will, O God. When God gets a hold of our hearts, we love to serve. I've been around Brother Allen enough. He is so delightful. He just keeps giving me CDs and he buys books and feeds me. He even brought me breakfast when I was in bed this morning. I wasn't even up yet. And I got this knock on the door and he said, Brother Chester, would you like some breakfast? I wasn't even dressed. I opened up the door and there was a whole plate full of food. It was so much food I couldn't even eat it all. Okay, that's Brother Allen. Okay. So he's demonstrating this kind of no limit kind of stuff. Now, do you notice there's no question what's wrong with it. Rather, there's a question, what's right with it? How can I serve? You see? That's stage four. That's the higher ethic. It's the spontaneous byproduct of God's love working in us. And when young people see parents living like this, it generates that desire to connect with their parents who live like this. This is powerful stuff, folks. This is a powerful motivation for children to claim the faith of their fathers when they see their parents live like this. Let me show you some more things. That's just the beginning of the components of the higher ethic. Look at these. We talked about forgiveness. Gelassenheit. Didn't even start on that one. That's a whole subject in itself, Gelassenheit. We're not going to go there right now. Did talk about the Golden Rule. Did talk about Good Samaritan work. Humility. How many times are people allowed to be humble down here, Aiden? See, we could go on and on. What about selflessness? How much selflessness are we allowed to have? Well, it's no limit. How much joy are you allowed to have down here? It's just endless. Seeking first to understand rather than to be understood first. That's Christ-like. Willingness to suffer for being good. Never saying it's not fair, but rather Gelassenheit, accepting what God is bringing into my life. And I'm joyful about that. Rejoice and be exceeding glad whenever I'm being reviled and persecuted or misunderstood. I have a chance to identify with Christ in His sufferings. Removing plagues from my brother's eye, my own eye before I try to help my brother with his mote. I think you people down here are probably just as human as the rest of the world, is that your natural tendency is to pull motes out of other people's eye rather than deal with your own. It's my tendency. Integrity first. This is the component of the higher ethic. This is where we live. if we're mature. This is where Christian work gets done. When people have this kind of mentality, when they're living in a mature stage, then they can get involved in Christian service and be used by God to do all kinds of wonderful things in the world. This is normal Christian experience. This is where we should get to as soon as possible. Is it possible for a 14-year-old to get here? I have questions. Do some people never get here? They spend all their lives coming through stage 1, stage 2, stage 3? I'm afraid so. Some people only get as far as stage 2 and they stop. And that's sad. But the sooner we can get here, a church's responsibility is to help its people get here as soon as possible. It's our teaching program. It's the way we live in our homes. It's the way we relate to people in the world that teaches this. Some of this is just caught, not taught. You see, if we are relating to Christ with Galasinghite, it has two dimensions. It has a vertical dimension, submitting to God, letting go of ourselves and just giving Christ free reign in our lives. But Galasinghite also has a horizontal component to it. And we are into Galasinghite the way we should. It engenders resurrection, or we could say resurrection power. Christ is in us and releases His power to do all kinds of things in stage 4. It is a wonderful concept. It's more liberating than I can even explain to you. But it's done by the work of God in us as we surrender to Him. The golden circle of Christianity. I'll just go through this. Why? We love Jesus and desire to live in intimacy and oneness with Him. And when that's the case, then resurrection power kicks in. How? We see Christianity as a relationship, which means in everything we do, we keep the person of Jesus in our focus. We follow Him in all things and draw as close to Him as possible as we're in stage 4. What? Well, we can run around that circle. We do not lay up earthly treasures. We share with the poor. We make peace and forgive. We do not lie. We seek to be humble. We actively seek the lost. We have been born again and baptized. The fiber of who we are is love. We overcome temptation and sin. We speak to Jesus often. We love our enemies. We do not seek earthly power. See, all that is stage 4. That's the maturity stage. We radically obey Jesus' commandments. No spin, no complicated interpretations, no excuses. With passion, we live out His kingdom vision while dwelling in oneness with the King. It's like Brother Lucas is talking about being and doing together, all one unit. People aren't motivated by what you do as they look on our lives. They are motivated by why you do it. So start with why. Start with Him. And when people see Jesus in us, that is probably the most compelling reason for anybody to come into the faith, including our own children and our neighbors and whoever we relate to. Because when Christ is present in a person's life, it is obvious. You don't have to go tell people you're a Christian. They can just see it. It comes out all over. And young people respond to that. In conclusion, I got two more. Voluntarism. This is part of the stage 4. Voluntarism, where we want to versus whether we have to. You see, if we have to do something, there's something pushing back. I have to, but I don't want to. My flesh is pushing on me. But when we want to, when Christ is in, there's nothing pushing back. It's just like, I have a chance to do. Radically different perspectives.
Okay, here's the last one. The higher ethic, the ongoing operational platform. And this has to do with congregation now. Transformational congregational experience, where instead of being distressed about each other's standard violation, we give, as a church, the people who are struggling with standard violations, we give them the invitation to step up. We don't get the stick out and say, unless you step up, whack. You see, it's not the same. Secondly, if there are doctrinal divinations, we give the invitation to step up to orthodoxy. Now, folks, if somebody really doesn't want to step up, or they don't want to really get their doctrine in order, the way the congregation is understanding it, all churches have both a front door and a back door. We invite people in the front door, but if you don't want to be here, that's fine. You can leave. When people have to go through a lot of struggle to leave someplace, it's an indication that there's cultish practices there. Now, of course, we don't want to see people leaving. We have things that we need to do to help people so they don't leave recklessly. But what I'm trying to say here is, you don't force people into anything. You help people kick into the voluntary, I want to. You invite people to the better. If there is a party spirit, we don't get distressed and put threats on them. We invite them to maturity, to step up. If you don't want to stop being divisive, well, I mean, you can leave. You don't have to stay here. If there's questionable music, we invite to wholesomeness. Show what's better. If there's materialism, we're not distressed about it. Emphasize the spiritual delights. And just maybe they'll find the back door if they don't want to. If there's moral failure, invite repentance. If there's shallowness, invite to depth. If there's a lack of loyalty, invite to heartfelt presence. If there is worldliness, we're not distressed about it. We invite to the better things of godliness. But if nobody wants these things, you can leave. We're not going to make you stay here. It's called the transformational congregational experience. See, some of the things we were talking about was personal. Now this is congregational or collective experience. This is the higher ethic at work in the congregation. Okay, I got to stop talking. Maybe you have some questions or things that you'd like to discuss. We can take some lights. Okay, once again, I know I threw an awful lot at you. And if you just want to think about it, you're welcome to any kind of overheads. If you want to think about these things further, I invite you to make copies. Okay, if there's nothing, thank you for your attention. We'll turn it back to whoever's taking charge for lunch.